I want some answers, Stu said. I'm sorry, but if you want me to cooperate, give me some answers. In time, you will be... I can make it hard for you.
We know that, Denninger said peevishly. I simply don't have the authority to tell you anything, Mr. Redman. I know very little myself.
I guess you've been testing my blood, all those needles.
That's right, Denninger said warily.
What for?
Once more, Mr. Redman, I can't tell you what I don't know.
The peevish tone was back again, and Stu was inclined to believe him. He was nothing but a glorified technician on this job, and he didn't like it much.
They put my hometown under quarantine.
I know nothing about that either.
But Denninger cut his eyes away from Stu's, and this time Stu thought he was lying.
How come I haven't seen anything about it?
He pointed to the TV set bolted to the wall.
I beg your pardon?
When they roadblock off a town and put barbed wire around it, that's news, Stu said.
Mr. Redman, if you'll only let Patty take your blood pressure,
no. If you want any more from me, you better send two big strong men to get it. And no matter how many you send, I'm going to try to rip some holes in those germ suits. They don't look all that strong, you know it?
He made a playful grab at Denninger's suit, and Denninger skipped backward and nearly fell over. The speaker of his intercom emitted a terrified squawk, and there was a stir behind the double glass.
I guess you could feed me something in my food to knock me out, but that'd mix up your tests, wouldn't it?
Mr. Redman, you're not being reasonable.
Denninger was keeping a prudent distance away.
Your lack of cooperation may do your country a grave disservice. Do you understand me?
Nope, Stu said. Right now it looks to me like it's my country doing me a grave disservice. It's got me locked up in a hospital room in Georgia with a buttermouthed little pissant doctor who doesn't know shit from Shinola. Get your ass out of here and send somebody in to talk to me or send enough boys to take what you need by force. I'll fight 'em, you can count on that.
He sat perfectly still in his chair after Denninger left. The nurse didn't come back. Two strong orderlies did not appear to take his blood pressure by force. Now that he thought about it, he supposed that even such a small thing as a blood pressure reading wouldn't be much good if obtained under duress. For the time being, they were leaving him to simmer in his own juices. He got up and turned on the TV and watched it unseeingly. His fear was big inside him, a runaway elephant. For 2 days he had been waiting to start sneezing, coughing, hawking black phlegm, and spitting it into the commode. He wondered about the others, people he had known all his life. He wondered if any of them were as bad off as Campion had been. He thought of the dead woman and her baby in that old Chevy, and he kept seeing Lila Bruette's face on the woman and little Cheryl Hodges' face on the baby. The TV squawked and crackled. His heart beat slowly in his chest. Faintly, he could hear the sound of an air purifier sighing air into the room. He felt his fear twisting and turning inside him beneath his poker face. Sometimes it was big and panicky, trampling everything, the elephant. Sometimes it was small and gnawing, ripping with sharp teeth, the rat. It was always with him. But it was 40 hours before they sent him a man who would talk.
Chapter 8. On June 18th, 5 hours after he had talked to his cousin Bill Hapscom, Joe Bob Brentwood pulled down a speeder on Texas Highway 40 about 25 miles east of Arnett. The speeder was Harry Trent of Braintree, an insurance man. He had been doing 65 miles per in a 50-mile-an-hour zone. Joe Bob gave him a speeding ticket. Trent accepted it humbly, and then amused Joe Bob by trying to sell him insurance on his house and his life. Joe Bob felt fine. Dying was the last thing on his mind. Nevertheless, he was already a sick man. He had gotten more than gas at Bill Hapscom's Texaco, and he gave Harry Trent more than a speeding summons. Harry, a gregarious man who liked his job, passed the sickness to more than 40 people during that day and the next. How many those 40 passed it to is impossible to say. You might as well ask how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. If you were to make a conservative estimate of 5 apiece, you'd have 200. Using the same conservative formula, one could say those 200 went on to infect 1,000, the 1,000, 5,000, the 5,000, 25,000. under the California desert and subsidized by the taxpayers' money, someone had finally invented a chain letter that really worked. A very lethal chain letter. On June 19th, the day Larry Underwood came home to New York and the day that Franny Goldsmith told her father about her impending little stranger, Harry Trent stopped at an East Texas cafe called Babe's Quick Eat for lunch. He had the cheeseburger platter and a piece of Babe's delicious strawberry pie for dessert. He had a slight cold, an allergy cold maybe, and he kept sneezing and having to spit. In the course of the meal, he infected Babe, the dishwasher, two truckers in a corner booth, the man who came in to deliver bread, and the man who came in to change the records on the juke. He left the sweet thing that waited his table a dollar tip that was crawling with death. On his way out, a station wagon pulled in. There was a roof rack on top, and the wagon was piled high with kids and luggage. The wagon had New York plates, and the driver, who rolled down his window to ask Harry how to get to U.S. 21 going north, had a New York accent. Harry gave the New York fellow very clear directions on how to get to Highway 21. He also served him and his entire family their death warrants, without even knowing it. The New Yorker was Edward M. Norris, Lieutenant of Police, Detective Squad, in the Big Apple's 87th Precinct. This was his first real vacation in 5 years. He and his family had had a fine time. The kids had been in seventh heaven at Disney World in Orlando, and not knowing the whole family would be dead by the 2nd of July, Norris planned to tell that sour son of a bitch Steve Carella that it was possible to take your wife and kids someplace by car and have a good time. "Steve," he would say, "you may be a fine detective, but a man who can't police his own family ain't worth a pisshole drilled in a snowbank." The Norris family had a quick eat at Babe's, then followed Harry Trent's admirable directions to Highway 21. Ed and his wife Trish marveled over Southern hospitality while the three kids colored in the back seat. Christ only knew, Ed thought, what Corella's pair of monsters would have been up to. That night they stayed in a Eustis, Oklahoma travel court. Ed and Trish infected the clerk. The kids, Marcia, Stanley, and Hector, infected the kids they played with on the tourist court's playground. Kids bound for West Texas, Alabama, Arkansas, and Tennessee. Trish infected the two women who were washing clothes at the laundromat 2 blocks away. Ed, on his way down the motel corridor to get some ice, infected a fellow he passed in the hallway. Everybody got into the act. Trish woke Ed up in the early morning hours to tell him that Heck, the baby, was sick. He had an ugly, rasping cough and was running a fever. It sounded to her like the croup. Ed Norris groaned and told her to give the kid some aspirin. If the kid's goddamn croup could only have held off another 4 or 5 days, he could have had it in his very own house, and Ed would have been left with the memory of a perfect vacation, not to mention the anticipation of all that gloating he planned to do. He could hear the poor kid through the connecting door, hacking away like a hound dog. Trish expected that Hector's symptoms would abate in the morning. Croup was a lying-down sickness. But by noon of the 20th, she admitted to herself that it wasn't happening. The aspirin wasn't controlling the fever. Poor Heck was just glass-eyed with it. His cough had taken on a booming note she didn't like, and his respiration sounded labored and phlegmy. Whatever it was, Marcia seemed to be coming down with it, too, and Trish had a nasty little tickle in the back of her own throat that was making her cough, although so far it was only a light cough she could smother in a small hanky. "We've got to get Heck to a doctor," she said finally. Ed pulled into a service station and checked the map paper-clipped to the station wagon's sun visor. They were in Hammer Crossing, Kansas. "I don't know," he said. "Maybe we can at least find a doctor who'll give us a referral." He sighed and ran an aggravated hand through his hair. "Hammer Crossing, Kansas, Jesus! Why do you have to get sick enough to need a doctor at some goddamn nothing place like this?" Marcia, who was looking at the map over her father's shoulder, said, "It says Jesse James robbed the bank here, Daddy, twice." "Fuck Jesse James," Ed grumped. "Ed!" Trish cried. "Sorry," he said, not feeling sorry in the least. He drove on. After 6 calls, during each of which Ed Norris carefully held his temper with both hands, he finally found a doctor in Polliston who would look at Hector if they could get him there by 3. Polliston was off their route, 20 miles west of Hammer Crossing, but now the important thing was Hector. Ed was getting very worried about him. He'd never seen the kid with so little oomph in him. They were waiting in the outer office of Dr. Brendan Sweeney by 2 in the afternoon. By then, Ed was sneezing, too. Sweeney's waiting room was full. They didn't get in to see the doctor until nearly 4 o'clock. Trish couldn't rouse Heck to more than a sludgy semi-consciousness, and she felt feverish herself. Only Stan Norris, age 9, still felt good enough to fidget. During their wait in Sweeney's office, they communicated the sickness, which would soon be known across the disintegrating country as Captain Trips, to more than 25 people, including a matronly woman who just came in to pay her bill before going on to pass the disease to her entire bridge club. This matronly woman was Mrs. Robert Bradford, Sarah Bradford to the bridge club, Cookie to her husband and close friends. Sarah played well that night, possibly because her partner was Angela Dupre, her best friend. They seemed to enjoy a happy kind of telepathy. They won all 3 rubbers resoundingly, making a grand slam during the last. For Sarah, the only fly in the ointment was that she seemed to be coming down with a slight cold. It wasn't fair arriving so soon on the heels of the last one. She and Angela went out for a quiet drink in a cocktail bar after the party broke up at 10. Angela was in no hurry to get home. It was David's turn to have the weekly poker game at their house, and she just wouldn't be able to sleep with all that noise going on, unless she had a little self-prescribed sedative first, which in her case would be 2 slow gin fizzes. Sarah had a Ward 8, and the 2 women rehashed the bridge game. In the meantime, they managed to infect everyone in the Polliston cocktail bar, including 2 young men drinking beer nearby. They were on their way to California, just as Larry Underwood and his friend Rudy Schwartz had once gone, to seek their fortunes. A friend of theirs had promised them jobs with a moving company. The next day they headed west, spreading the disease as they went. Chain letters don't work. It's a known fact. The $1 million or so you are promised if you'll just send one single dollar to the name at the top of the list, add yours to the bottom, and then send the letter on to 5 friends, never arrives. This one, the Captain Trips chain letter, worked very well. The pyramid was indeed being built, not from the bottom up, but from the tip down, said tip being a deceased Army security guard named Charles Campion. All the chickens were coming home to roost. Only instead of the mailman bringing each participant bale after bale of letters, each containing a single dollar bill, Captain Trips brought bales of bedrooms with a body or two in each one, and trenches, and dead pits, and finally bodies slung into the oceans on each coast and into quarries and into the foundations of unfinished houses. And in the end, of course, the bodies would rot where they fell. Sarah Bradford and Angela Dupre walked back to their parked cars together, infecting 4 or 5 people they met on the street, then pecked cheeks and went their separate ways. Sarah went home to infect her husband and his 5 poker buddies and her teenaged daughter, Samantha. Unknown to her parents, Samantha was terribly afraid she had caught a dose of the clap from her boyfriend. As a matter of fact, she had. As a further matter of fact, she had nothing to worry about. Next to what her mother had given her, a good working dose of the clap was every bit as serious as a little eczema of the eyebrows. The next day, Samantha would go on to infect everybody in the swimming pool at the Polliston YWCA. And so on. Chapter 9. They set on him sometime after dusk, while he was walking up the shoulder of U.S. Route 27, which was called Main Street a mile back where it passed through town. A mile or 2 farther on, he had been planning to turn west on 63, which would have taken him to the turnpike and the start of his long trip north. His senses had been dulled, maybe, by the 2 beers he had just downed, but he had known something was wrong. He was just getting around to remembering the 4 or 5 heavy-set townies down at the far end of the bar when they broke cover and ran at him. Nick put up the best fight he could, decking one of them and bloodying another's nose, breaking it, too, by the sound. For 1 or 2 hopeful moments, he thought there was actually a chance that he might win. The fact that he fought without making any sound at all was unnerving them a little. They were soft. Maybe they had done this before with no trouble, and they certainly hadn't expected a serious fight from this skinny kid with the knapsack. Then one of them caught him just over the chin, shredding his lower lip with some sort of a school ring, and the warm taste of blood gushed into his mouth. He stumbled backward, and someone pinned his arms. He struggled wildly and got one hand free just as a fist looped down into his face like a runaway moon. Before it closed his right eye, he saw that ring again, glittering dully in the starlight. He saw stars and felt his consciousness start to diffuse, drifting away into parts unknown. Scared, he struggled harder. The man wearing the ring was back in front of him now, and Nick, afraid of being cut again, kicked him in the belly. Schoolring's breath went out of him, and he doubled over, making a series of breathless woofing sounds, like a terrier with laryngitis. The others closed in. To Nick, they were only shapes now, beefy men, good old boys, they called themselves, in gray shirts with the sleeves rolled up to show their big sun-freckled biceps. They wore blocky work shoes. Tangles of oily hair fell over their brows. In the last fading light of day, all of this began to seem like a malign dream. Blood ran into his open eye. The knapsack was torn from his back. Blows rained down on him, and he became a boneless, jittering puppet on a fraying string. Consciousness would not quite desert him. The only sounds were their out-of-breath gasps as they pistoned their fists into him, and the liquid twitter of a nightjar in the deep stand of pine close by. School Ring had staggered to his feet. "Hold him," he said. "Hold him by the har." Hands grasped his arms. Somebody else twined both hands into Nick's springy black hair. "Why don't he yell out?" one of the others asked, agitated. "Why don't he yell out, Ray?"
"I told you not to use any names," Signet Ring said. "I don't give a fuck why he don't yell out. I'm gonna mess him up. Sucker kicked me. Goddamn dirty fighter, that's what he is."
The fist looped down. Nick jerked his head aside, and the ring furrowed his cheek.
"Hold him, I told you," Ray said. "What are y'all, bunch of pussies?"
The fist looped down again, and Nick's nose became a squashed and dripping tomato. His breath clogged to a snuffle. Consciousness was down to a narrow pencil beam. His mouth dropped open, and he scooped in night air. The nightjar sang again, sweet and solace. Nick heard it this time no more than he had the last.
"Hold him," Ray said. "Hold him, goddammit!"
The fist looped down. Two of his front teeth shattered as the school ring snowplowed through them. It was an agony he couldn't scream about. His legs unhinged, and he sagged, held like a grain sack now by the hands behind him.
"Ray, that's enough. You want to kill him?" "Hold him. Sucker kicked me. I'm gonna mess him up."
Then lights were splashing down the road, which was bordered here by underbrush and interlaced with huge old pines.
"Oh, Jesus! Dump him! Dump him!"
That was Ray's voice, but Ray was no longer in front of him. Nick was dimly grateful, but most of what little consciousness he had left was taken up with the agony in his mouth. He could taste flecks of his teeth on his tongue. Hands pushed him, propelling him out into the center of the road. Oncoming circles of light pinned him there like an actor on a stage. Brakes screamed. Nick pinwheeled his arms and tried to make his legs go, but his legs wouldn't oblige. They had given him up for dead. He collapsed on the composition surface, and the screaming sound of brakes and tires filled the world as he waited numbly to be run over. At least it would put an end to the pain in his mouth. Then a splatter of pebbles struck his cheek, and he was looking at a tire which had come to a stop less than a foot from his face. He could see a small white rock embedded between two of the treads, like a coin held between a pair of knuckles. "Piece of quartz," he thought disjointedly, and passed out. When Nick came to, he was lying on a bunk. It was a hard one, but in the last 3 years or so he had lain on harder. He struggled his eyes open with great effort. They seemed gummed shut, and the right one, the one that had been hit by the runaway moon, would only come to half-mast. He was looking at a cracked gray cement ceiling. Pipes wrapped in insulation zigzagged beneath it. A large beetle was trundling busily along one of these pipes. Bisecting his field of vision was a chain. He raised his head slightly, sending a monstrous bolt of pain through it, and saw another chain running from the outside foot of the bunk to a bolt in the wall. He turned his head to the left, another bolt of pain, this one not so killing, and saw a rough concrete wall. Cracks ran through it. It had been extensively written on. Some of the writing was new, some old, most illiterate. This place has bugs. Louis Dragonsky, 1987. I like it in my asshole. DTs can be fun. George Rampling is a jerk-off. I still love you, Suzanne. This place sucks, Jerry. Clyde D. Fred, 1981. There were pictures of large dangling penises, gigantic breasts, crudely drawn vaginas. It all gave Nick a sense of place. He was in a jail cell. Carefully, he propped himself on his elbows, let his feet, clad in paper slippers, drop over the edge of the cot, and then swung up to a sitting position. The large economy-size pain rocked his head again, and his backbone gave out an alarming creak. His stomach rolled alarmingly in his gut, and a fainting kind of nausea seized him, the most dismaying and unmanning kind, the kind that makes you feel like crying out to God to make it stop. Instead of crying out, he couldn't have done that. Nick leaned over his knees, one hand on each cheek, and waited for it to pass. After a while, it did. He could feel the band-aids that had been placed over the furrow on his cheek, and by wrinkling that side of his face a couple of times, he decided that some sawbones had sunk a couple of stitches in there for good measure. He looked around. He was in a small cell shaped like a saltine box, stood on end. Beyond the end of the cot was a barred door. At the head of the cot was a lidless, ringless toilet. Behind and above him, he saw this by craning his stiff neck very, very carefully, was a small barred window. After he had sat on the edge of the cot long enough to feel sure he wasn't going to pass out, he hooked the shapeless gray pajama pants he was wearing down around his knees, squatted on the can, and urinated for what seemed at least an hour. When he was finished, he stood up, holding on to the edge of the cot like an old man. He looked apprehensively into the bowl for signs of blood, but his urine had been clear. He flushed it away. He walked carefully over to the barred door and looked out into a short corridor. To his left was the drunk tank. An old man was lying on one of its five bunks, a hand like driftwood dangling on the floor. To the right, the corridor ended in a door that was chocked open. In the center of the corridor was a dangling green-shaded light like the kind he had seen in pool halls. A shadow rose, danced on the propped-open door, and then a large man in khaki suntans walked into the corridor. He was wearing a Sam Brown belt and a big pistol. He hooked his thumbs into his pants pockets and looked at Nick for almost a full minute without speaking. Then he said, "When I was a boy, we caught ourselves a mountain lion up in the hills and shot it and then drug it 20 miles back to town over dirt hard pan. What was left of that creature when we got home was the sorriest-looking sight I ever saw. You the second sorriest, boy." Nick thought it had the feel of a prepared speech, carefully honed and treasured, saved for out-of-towners and vagues that occupied the barred saltine boxes from time to time. "You got a name, Babaluga?" Nick put a finger to his swelled and lacerated lips and shook his head. He put a hand over his mouth, then cut the air with it in a soft diagonal hash mark and shook his head again. "What? Can't talk? What's this happy horse shit?" The words were amiable enough, but Nick couldn't follow tones or inflections. He plucked an invisible pen from the air and wrote with it. "You want a pencil?" Nick nodded. "If you're mute, how come you don't have none of those cards?" Nick shrugged. He turned out his empty pockets. He balled his fists and shadow-boxed the air, which sent another bolt of pain through his head and another wave of nausea through his stomach. He finished by tapping his own temples lightly with his fists, rolling his eyes up and sagging on the bars. Then he pointed to his empty pockets. "You were robbed." Nick nodded. The man in khaki turned away and went back into his office. A moment later he returned with a dull pencil and a notepad. He thrust them through the bars. Written across the top of each note sheet was "Memo," and "From the desk of Sheriff John Baker." Nick turned the pad around and tapped the pencil eraser at the name. He raised questioning eyebrows. "Yeah, that's me. Who are you?" "Nick Andros," he wrote. He put his hand through the bars. Baker shook his head. "I ain't gonna shake with you. You deaf, too?" Nick nodded. "What happened to you tonight? Doc Soames and his wife almost ran you down like a woodchuck, boy." "Beat up and robbed, a mile or so from a roadhouse on Main Street, Zach's place." "That hangout's no place for a kid like you, Babaluga.
You surely ain't old enough to drink.
Nick shook his head indignantly. I'm 22, he wrote. I can have a couple of beers without getting beaten up and robbed for them, can't I? Baker read this with a sourly amused look on his face.
It don't appear you can, and show you. What you doing here, kid?
Nick tore the first sheet off the memo pad, crumpled it in a ball, dropped it on the floor. Before he could begin to write his reply, an arm shot through the bars and a steel hand clutched his shoulder. Nick's head jerked up.
My wife neatens these cells, Baker said, and I don't see any need for you to litter yours up. Go throw that in the John.
Nick bent over, wincing at the pain in his back, and fished the ball of paper off the floor. He took it over to the toilet, tossed it in, and then looked up at Baker with his eyebrows raised. Baker nodded. Nick came back. This time he wrote longer, pencil flying over the paper. Baker reflected that teaching a deaf-mute kid to read and write was probably quite a trick, and this Nick Andros must have some pretty good equipment upstairs to have caught the hang of it. There were fellows here in Shoyo, Arkansas, who had never properly caught the hang of it, and more than a few of them hung out in Zach's. But he supposed you couldn't expect a kid who just blew into town to know that. Nick handed the pad through the bars. I've been traveling around, but I'm not a vague. Spent today working for a man named Rich Ellerton about 6 miles west of here. I cleaned his barn and put up a load of hay in his loft. Last week I was in Watts, Oklahoma, running fence. The men who beat me up got my week's pay.
You sure it was Rich Ellerton you was working for? I can check that, you know.
Baker had torn off Nick's explanation, folded it to wallet photo size, and tucked it into his shirt pocket. Nick nodded.
You see his dog?
Nick nodded.
What kind was it?
Nick gestured for the pad. Big Doberman, he wrote, but nice, not mean. Baker nodded, turned away, and went back into his office. Nick stood at the bars, watching anxiously. A moment later, Baker returned with a big key ring, unlocked the holding cell, and pushed it back on its track.
Come on in the office, Baker said. You want some breakfast?
Nick shook his head, then made pouring and drinking motions.
Coffee? Got that. You take cream and sugar?
Nick shook his head.
Take it like a man, huh?
Baker laughed.
Come on.
Baker started up the hallway, and although he was speaking, Nick was unable to hear what he was saying with his back turned and his lips hidden.
I don't mind the company. I got insomnia. It's got so I can't sleep more than 3 or 4 hours most nights. My wife wants me to go see some big-shot doctor up in Pine Bluff. If it keeps on, I just might do it. I mean, look at this. Here I am, 5 in the morning, not even light out, and there I sit eating eggs and greasy home fries from the truck stop up the road.
He turned on the last phrase, and Nick caught, "Truck stop up the road." He raised his eyebrows and shrugged his shoulders to indicate his puzzlement.
Don't matter, Baker said. Not to a young kid like you, anyway.
In the outer office, Baker poured him a cup of black coffee out of a huge thermos. The sheriff's half-finished breakfast plate stood on his desk blotter, and he pulled it back to himself. Nick sipped the coffee. It hurt his mouth, but it was good. He tapped Baker on the shoulder, and when he looked up, Nick pointed to the coffee, rubbed his stomach, and winked soberly. Baker smiled.
You better say it's good. My wife Jane puts it up.
He tucked half a hard-fried egg into his mouth, chewed, and then pointed at Nick with his fork.
You're pretty good, just like one of those pantomimers. Bet you don't have much trouble making yourself understood, huh?
Nick made a seesawing gesture with his hand in midair.
Come see, come saw. I ain't gonna hold you, Baker said, mopping up grease with a slice of toasted Wonder Bread. But I tell you what, if you stick around, maybe we can get the guys who did this to you. You game?
Nick nodded and wrote, You think I can get my week's pay back?
Not a chance, Baker said flatly. I'm just a hick sheriff boy. For something like that, you'd be wanting Oral Roberts.
Nick nodded and shrugged. Putting his hands together, he made a bird flying away.
Yeah, like that. How many were there?
Nick held up 4 fingers, shrugged, then held up 5.
You think you could identify any of them?
Nick held up 1 finger and wrote, Big and blonde. Your size, maybe a little heavier. Gray shirt and pants. He was wearing a big ring, third finger right hand, purple stone. That's what cut me. As Baker read this, a change came over his face. First concern, then anger. Nick, thinking the anger was directed against him, became frightened again.
"Oh, Jesus Christ," Baker said. "This here's a full commode sloppin' over for sure. You sure?"
Nick nodded reluctantly. "Anything else? You see anything else?" Nick thought hard, then wrote, "Small scar on his forehead." Baker looked at the words.
"That's Ray Booth," he said. "My brother-in-law. Thanks, kid. 5 in the morning and my day's wrecked already."
Nick's eyes opened a little wider, and he made a cautious gesture of commiseration.
"Well, all right," Baker said, more to himself than to Nick. "He's a bad actor. Janie knows it. He beat her up enough times when they was kids together. Still, they're brother and sister, and I guess I can forget my lovin' for this week."
Nick looked down, embarrassed. After a moment, Baker shook his shoulder so that Nick would see him speaking.
"It probably won't do any good anyway," he said. "Ray and his jerk-off buddies'll just swear each other up. Your word against theirs. Did you get any licks in?"
"Kick this Ray in the guts," Nick wrote. "Got another one in the nose. Might have broken it."
"Ray chums around with Vince Hogan, Billy Warner, and Mike Childress, mostly," Baker said. "I might be able to get Vince alone and break him down. He's got all the spine of a dying jellyfish. If I could get him, I could go after Mike and Billy. Ray got that ring in a fraternity at LSU. He flunked out his sophomore year."
He paused, drumming his fingers against the rim of his breakfast plate.
"I guess we could give it a go, kid, if you wanted to. But I'll warn you in advance, we probably won't get them. They're as vicious and cowardly as a dog pack, but they're town boys and you're just a deaf-mute drifter. And if they got off, they'd come after you."
Nick thought about it. In his mind, he kept coming back to the image of himself, being shoved from one of them to the next like a bleeding scarecrow, and to Ray's lips forming the words, "I'm gonna mess him up. Sucker kicked me." To the feel of his knapsack, that old friend of the last 2 wandering years, being ripped from his back. On the memo pad, he wrote and underlined 2 words. "Let's try." Baker sighed and nodded.
"Okay. Vince Hogan works down to the sawmill. Well, that ain't just true. What he does mostly is fucks off down to the sawmill. We'll take a ride down there about 9, if that's fine with you. Maybe we can get him scared enough to spill the beans."
Nick nodded.
"How's your mouth? Doc Soames left some pills. He said it'd probably be a misery to you."
Nick nodded ruefully.
"I'll get him. It—"
He broke off, and in Nick's silent movie world, he watched the sheriff explode several sneezes into his handkerchief.
"That's another thing," he went on, but he had turned away now, and Nick caught only the first word. "I'm coming down with a real good cold. Jesus Christ, ain't life grand. Welcome to Arkansas, boy."
He got the pills and came back to where Nick sat. After he passed them and a glass of water to Nick, Baker rubbed gently under the angle of his jaw. There was a definite painful swelling there. Swollen glands, coughing, sneezing, a low fever, felt like. Yeah, it was shaping up to be a wonderful day.
Chapter 10
Larry woke up with a hangover that was not too bad, a mouth that tasted as if a baby dragon had used it for a potty chair, and a feeling that he was somewhere he shouldn't be. The bed was a single, but there were 2 pillows on it. He could smell frying bacon. He sat up, looked out the windows at another gray New York day, and his first thought was that they had done something horrible to Berkeley overnight, turned it dirty and sooty, had aged it. Then last night began coming back, and he realized he was looking at Fordham, not Berkeley. He was in a second-floor flat on Tremont Avenue, not far from the concourse, and his mother was going to wonder where he had been last night. Had he called her, given her any kind of excuse, no matter how thin? He swung his legs out of bed and found a crumpled pack of Winston's with 1 crazy cigarette left in it. He lit it with a green plastic Bic lighter. It tasted like dead horse shit. Out in the kitchen, the sound of frying bacon went on and on, like radio static. The girl's name was Maria, and she had said she was a... what? Oral hygienist, was that it? Larry didn't know how much she knew about hygiene, but she was great on oral. He vaguely remembered being gobbled like a Purdue drumstick. Crosby, Stills, and Nash on a crappy little stereo in the living room, singing about how much water had gone underneath the bridge, time we had wasted on the way. If his memory was correct, Maria sure hadn't wasted much time. She had been a little overwhelmed to discover he was that Larry Underwood. At one point in the evening's festivities, hadn't they gone out reeling around looking for an open record store so they could buy a copy of Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? He groaned very softly and tried to retrace yesterday from its innocuous beginnings to its frantic, gobbling finale. The Yankees weren't in town, he remembered that. His mother had been gone to work when he woke up, but she had left a Yankees schedule on the kitchen table along with a note. Larry, as you can see, the Yankees won't be back until July 1. They are playing a doubleheader the 4th of July. If you're not doing anything that day, why not take your mom to the ballpark? I'll buy the beer and hot dogs. There are eggs and sausage in the fridge or sweet rolls in the bread box if you like them better. Take care of yourself, kiddo. There was a typical Alice Underwood P.S. Most of the kids you hung around with are gone now, and good riddance to that bunch of hoods, but I think Buddy Marks is working at that print shop on Stricker Avenue. Just thinking of that note was enough to make him wince. No dear before his name, no love before her signature. She didn't believe in phony stuff. The real stuff was in the refrigerator. Sometime while he had been sleeping off his drive across America, she had gone out and stocked up on every goddamn thing in the world that he liked. Her memory was so perfect it was frightening. A Daisy canned ham, 2 pounds of real butter. How the hell could she afford that on her salary? 2 six-packs of Coke, deli sausages, a roast of beef already marinating in Alice's secret sauce, the contents of which she refused to divulge even to her son, and a gallon of Baskin-Robbins Peach Delight ice cream in the freezer, along with a Sara Lee cheesecake, the kind with strawberries on top. On impulse, he had gone into the bathroom, not just to take care of his bladder, but to check the medicine cabinet. A brand-new Pepsodent toothbrush was hanging in the old holder, where all of his childhood toothbrushes had hung, one after another. There was a package of disposable razors in the cabinet, a can of Barbasol shave cream, even a bottle of Old Spice cologne. Not fancy, she would have said. Larry could actually hear her, but smelly enough for the money. He had stood looking at these things, then had taken the new tube of toothpaste out and held it in his hand. No dear, no love, Mom. Just a new toothbrush, new tube of toothpaste, new bottle of cologne. Sometimes, he thought, real love is silent as well as blind. He began brushing his teeth, wondering if there might not be a song in that someplace. The oral hygienist came in, wearing a pink nylon half-slip and nothing else. "Hi, Larry," she said. She was short, pretty in a vague Sandra Dee sort of way, and her breasts pointed at him perkily without a sign of a sag. What was the old joke? That's right, loot. She had a pair of 38s and a real gun. Ha ha, very funny. He had come 3,000 miles to spend the night being eaten alive by Sandra Dee. "Hi," he said, and got up. He was naked, but his clothes were at the foot of the bed. He began to put them on. "I've got a robe you can wear if you want to. We're having kippers and bacon." Kippers and bacon? His stomach began to shrivel and fold in on itself. "No, honey, I've got to run. Someone I've got to see." "Oh, hey, you can't just run out on me like that. Really, it's important." "Well, I'm important, too." She was becoming strident. It hurt Larry's head. For no particular reason, he thought of Fred Flintstone bellowing, "Wilma!" at the top of his cartoon lungs. "Your Bronx is showing, love," he said. "What's that supposed to mean?" She planted her hands on her hips, the greasy spatula sticking out of one closed fist like a steel flower. Her breasts jiggled fetchingly, but Larry wasn't fetched. He stepped into his pants and buttoned them. "So I'm from the Bronx. Does that make me black? What have you got against the Bronx? What are you, some kind of racist?
Nothing, and I don't think so, he said, and walked over to her in his bare feet. Listen, somebody I have to meet is my mother. I just got into town 2 days ago, and I didn't call her last night or anything. Did I? He added hopefully.
You didn't call anybody, she said sullenly. I just bet it's your mother.
He walked back to the bed and stuck his feet in his loafers.
It is, really. She works in the chemical bank building. She's a housekeeper.
Well, these days I guess she's a floor supervisor.
I bet you aren't the Larry Underwood that has that record either.
You believe what you want. I have to run.
You cheap prick, she flashed at him. What am I supposed to do with all the stuff I cooked?
Throw it out the window, he suggested.
She uttered a high squawk of anger and hurled the spatula at him. On any other day of his life, it would have missed. One of the first laws of physics was, to wit, a spatula will not fly a straight trajectory if hurled by an angry oral hygienist. Only this was the exception that proved the rule. Flip-flop, up and over, smash, right into Larry's forehead. It didn't hurt much. Then he saw two drops of blood fall on the throw rug as he bent over to pick the spatula up. He advanced 2 steps with the spatula in his hand.
I ought to paddle you with this, he shouted at her.
Sure, she said, cringing back and starting to cry. Why not? Big star, fuck and run. I thought you were a nice guy. You ain't no nice guy.
Several tears ran down her cheeks, dropped from her jaw, and plopped onto her upper chest. Fascinated, he watched one of them roll down the slope of her right breast and perch on the nipple. It had a magnifying effect. He could see pores and one black hair sprouting from the inner edge of the aureole.
Jesus Christ, I'm going crazy, he thought wonderingly.
I have to go, he said. His white cloth jacket was on the foot of the bed. He picked it up and slung it over his shoulder.
You ain't no nice guy, she cried at him as he went into the living room. I only went with you because I thought you were a nice guy.
The sight of the living room made him feel like groaning. On the couch where he dimly remembered being gobbled were at least 2 dozen copies of Baby Can You Dig Your Man. 3 more were on the turntable of the dusty portable stereo. On the far wall was a huge poster of Ryan O'Neill and Ally McGraw. Being gobbled means never having to say you're sorry, ha-ha. Jesus, I am going crazy. She stood in the bedroom doorway, still crying, pathetic in her half-slip. He could see a nick on one of her shins where she had cut herself shaving.
Listen, give me a call, she said. I ain't mad.
He should have said, sure, and that would have been the end of it. Instead, he heard his mouth utter a crazy laugh, and then, your kippers are burning. She screamed at him and started across the room, only to trip over a throw pillow on the floor and go sprawling. One of her arms knocked over a half-empty bottle of milk and rocked the empty bottle of scotch standing next to it. Holy God, Larry thought. Were we mixing those? He got out quickly and pounded down the stairs. As he went down the last 6 steps to the front door, he heard her in the upstairs hall yelling down,
You ain't no nice guy! You ain't no—
He slammed the door behind him, and misty, humid warmth washed over him, carrying the aroma of spring trees and automobile exhaust. It was perfume after the smell of frying grease and stale cigarette smoke. He still had the crazy cigarette, now burned down to the filter, and he threw it into the gutter and took a deep breath of the fresh air. Wonderful to be out of that craziness. Return with us not to those wonderful days of normalcy as we— Above and behind him, a window went up with a rattling bang, and he knew what was coming next.
I hope you rot,
she screamed down at him. The complete Bronx fishwife.
I hope you fall in front of some fucking subway train. You ain't no singer. You're shitty in bed, you louse. Pound this up your ass. Take this to your mother, you louse.
The milk bottle came zipping down from her second-floor bedroom window. Larry ducked. It went off in the gutter like a bomb, spraying the street with glass fragments. The scotch bottle came next, twirling end over end to crash nearly at his feet. Whatever else she was, her aim was terrifying. He broke into a run, holding one arm over his head. This madness was never going to end. From behind him came a final long braying cry, triumphant with juicy Bronx intonation.
"Kiss my ass, you cheap bastard!"
Then he was around the corner and on the expressway overpass, leaning over, laughing with a shaky intensity that was nearly hysteria, watching the cars pass below.
"Couldn't you have handled that better?" he said, totally unaware he was speaking out loud. "Oh, man, you could have done better than that. That was a bad scene. Crap on that, man."
He realized he was speaking aloud, and another burst of laughter escaped him. He suddenly felt a dizzy, spinning nausea in his stomach and squeezed his eyes tightly closed. A memory circuit in the Department of Masochism clicked open, and he heard Wayne Stuckey saying, "There's something in you that's like biting on tin foil." He had treated the girl like an old whore on the morning after the frat house gangbang.
"You ain't no nice guy."
"I am, I am." But when the people at the big party had protested his decision to cut them off, he had threatened to call the police, and he had meant it, hadn't he? Yes, yes he had. Most of them were strangers, true, he could care if they crapped on a landmine. But four or five of the protesters had gone back to the old days. And Wayne Stuckey, that bastard, standing in the doorway with his arms folded like a hanging judge on the big day. Sal Doria going out saying, "If this is what it does to guys like you, Larry, I wish you were still playing sessions." He opened his eyes and turned away from the overpass, looking for a cab. Oh, sure, the outraged friend bit. If Sal was such a big friend, what was he doing there sucking off him in the first place? I was stupid, and nobody likes to see a stupid guy wise up. That's the real story.
"You ain't no nice guy."
"I am a nice guy," he said sulkily. "And whose business is it anyway?" A cab was coming, and Larry flagged it. It seemed to hesitate a moment before pulling up to the curb, and Larry remembered the blood on his forehead. He opened the back door and climbed in before the guy could change his mind.
"Manhattan, the Chemical Bank building on Park," he said.
The cab pulled out into traffic.
"You got a cut on your forehead, guy," the cabbie said.
"A girl threw a spatula at me," Larry said absently. The cabbie offered him a strange false smile of commiseration and drove on, leaving Larry to settle back and try to imagine how he was going to explain his night out to his mother. Chapter 11. Larry found a tired-looking black woman on the lobby level who told him she thought Alice Underwood was up on the 24th floor doing an inventory. He got an elevator and went up, aware that the other people in the car were stealing cautious glances at his forehead. The wound there was no longer bleeding, but it had caked over into an unsightly mess. The 24th floor was taken up by the executive offices of a Japanese camera company. Larry walked up and down the halls for almost 20 minutes, looking for his mother and feeling like a horse's ass. There were plenty of Occidental executives, but enough of them were Japanese to make him feel, at 6'2", like a very tall horse's ass. The small men and women with the upslanted eyes looked at his caked forehead and bloody jacket sleeve with unsettling Oriental blandness. He finally spotted a door with custodian and housekeeping on it behind a very large fern. He tried the knob. The door was unlocked, and he peered inside. His mother was in there, dressed in her shapeless gray uniform, support hose, and crepe-soled shoes. Her hair was firmly caught under a black net. Her back was to him. She had a clipboard in one hand and seemed to be counting bottles of spray cleaner on a high shelf. Larry felt a strong and guilty impulse to just turn tail and run. Go back to the garage 2 blocks from her apartment building and get the Z. Fuck the 2 months' rent he had just laid down on the space. Just get in and boogie. Boogie where? Anywhere. Bar Harbor, Maine. Tampa, Florida. Salt Lake City, Utah. Any place would be a good place, as long as it was comfortably over the horizon from Dewey the Deck and from this soap-smelling little closet. He didn't know if it was the fluorescent lights or the cut on his forehead, but he was getting one fuck of a headache. Oh, quit whining, you goddamn sissy.
"Hi, Mom," he said.
She started a little, but didn't turn around.
"So, Larry, you found your way uptown?"
"Sure." He shuffled his feet. "I wanted to apologize. I should have called you last night."
"Yeah, good idea."
I stayed with Buddy. We went out steppin', did the town. I figured it was that or something like it. She hooked a small stool over with her foot, climbed up on it, and began to count the bottles of floor wax on the top shelf, touching each one lightly with the tips of her right thumb and forefinger as she went. She had to reach, and when she did, her dress pulled up, and he could see beyond the brown tops of her stockings to the waffled white flesh of her upper thighs, and he turned his eyes away, suddenly and aimlessly recalling what had happened to Noah's third son when he looked at his father as the old man lay drunk and naked on his pallet. Poor guy had ended up being a hewer of wood and fetcher of water ever after. Him and all his descendants. And that's why we have race riots today, son. Praise God. "Is that all you came to tell me?" she asked, looking around at him for the first time. "Well, where I was, and to apologize, it was crummy of me to forget." "Yeah," she said again, "but you got your crummy side to you, Larry. Did you think I forgot that?" He flushed. "Mom, listen, you're bleeding. Some stripper hit you with a loaded G-string?" She turned back to the shelves, and after she had counted the whole row of bottles on the top one, she made a notation on her clipboard. "Someone has had themselves 2 bottles of floor wax this past week," she remarked. "Lucky them." "I came to say I was sorry," Larry told her loudly. She didn't jump, but he did, a little. "Yeah, so you said. Mr. Gagan is going to be on us like a ton of bricks if the damn floor wax doesn't stop going out." "I didn't get in a barroom fight, and I wasn't in a strip joint. It wasn't anything like that. It was just..." He trailed off. She turned around, eyebrows arched in that old sardonic way he remembered so well. "Was what?" "Well..." He couldn't think of a convincing lie quick enough. "It was a... spatula." "Someone mistook you for a fried egg? Must have been quite a night you and Buddy had out on the town." He kept forgetting that she could run rings around him, had always been able to, probably always would. "It was a girl, Ma. She threw it at me." "She must be a hell of a shot," Alice Underwood said, and turned away again. "That dreaded Consuela is hiding the requisition forms again. Not that they do much good, we never get all the stuff we need, but we get plenty I wouldn't know what to do with if my life depended on it." "Ma, are you mad at me?" Her hands suddenly dropped to her sides. Her shoulders slumped. "Don't be mad at me," he whispered. "Don't be okay, huh?" She turned around, and he saw an unnatural sparkle in her eyes. Well, he supposed it was natural enough, but it sure wasn't caused by the fluorescence in here. And he heard the oral hygienist say once more with great finality, "You ain't no nice guy." Why had he ever bothered to come home if he was going to do stuff like this to her, and never mind what she was doing to him? "Larry," she said gently. "Larry, Larry, Larry." For a moment he thought she was going to say no more, even allowed himself to hope this was so. "Is that all you can say? Don't be mad at me, please, Ma, don't be mad. I hear you on the radio, and even though I don't like that song you sing, I'm proud it's you singing it. People ask me if that's really my son, and I say, yes, that's Larry. I tell them you could always sing, and that's no lie, is it?" He shook his head miserably, not trusting himself to speak. "I tell them how you picked up Donnie Roberts's guitar when you were in junior high, and how you were playing better than him in half an hour, even though he had lessons ever since second grade. You got talent, Larry. Nobody ever had to tell me that, least of all you. I guess you knew it, too, because it's the only thing I never heard you whine about. Then you went away. And am I beating you about the head and shoulders with that? No. Young men and young women, they go away. That's the nature of the world. Sometimes it stinks, but it's natural. Then you come back. Does somebody have to tell me why that is? No. You come back because, hit record or no hit record, you got in some kind of jam out there on the West Coast." "I'm not in any trouble," he said indignantly. "Yes, you are. I know the signs. I've been your mother for a long time, and you can't bullshit me, Larry. Trouble is something you have always looked around for when you couldn't just turn your head and see it. Sometimes I think you'd cross the street to step in dog shit. God will forgive me for saying it, because God knows it's true. Am I mad? No. Am I disappointed? Yes. I'd hoped you would change out there. You didn't. You went away a little boy in a man's body and you came back the same way, except the man got his hair processed. You know why I think you came home? He looked at her, wanting to speak, but knowing the only thing he would be able to say if he did would make them both mad.
Don't cry, Mom, huh?
I think you came home because you couldn't think where else to go. You didn't know who else would take you in. I never said a mean word about you to anyone else, Larry, not even to my own sister. But since you've pushed me to it, I'll tell you exactly what I think of you. I think you're a taker. You've always been one. It's like God left some part of you out when he built you inside of me. You're not bad. That's not what I mean. Some of the places we had to live after your father died, you would have gone bad if there was bad in you, God knows. I think the worst thing I ever caught you doing was writing a nasty word in the downstairs hall of that place on Carstairs Avenue in Queens. You remember that?
He remembered. She had chalked that same word on his forehead and then made him walk around the block with her 3 times. He had never written that word or any other word on a building, wall, or stoop.
The worst part, Larry, is that you mean well. Sometimes I think it would almost be a mercy if you were broke worse. As it is, you seem to know what's wrong, but not how to fix it. And I don't know how either. I tried every way I knew when you were small. Writing that word on your forehead, that was only one of them. And by then I was getting desperate, or I never would have done such a mean thing to you. You're a taker, that's all. You came home to me because you knew that I have to give. Not to everybody, but to you.
I'll move out, he said, and every word was like spitting out a dry ball of lint. This afternoon. Then it came to him that he probably couldn't afford to move out, at least not until Wayne sent him his next royalty check, or whatever was left of it after he finished feeding the hungriest of the L.A. hounds, on to him. As for current out-of-pocket expenses, there was the rent on the parking slot for the Datsun Z, and a hefty payment he would have to send out by Friday unless he wanted the friendly neighborhood repo man looking for him, and he didn't. And after last night's revel, which had begun so innocently with Buddy and his fiancée and this oral hygienist the fiancée knew, a nice girl from the Bronx, Larry, you'll love her, great sense of humor. He was pretty low on cash. No, if you wanted to be accurate, he was busted to his heels. The thought made him panicky. If he left his mother's now, where would he go? A hotel? The doorman at any hotel better than a flea bag would laugh his ass off and tell him to get lost. He was wearing good threads, but they knew. Somehow those bastards knew. They could smell an empty wallet.
Don't go, she said softly. I wish you wouldn't, Larry. I bought some food special. Maybe you saw it. And I was hoping maybe we could play some gin rummy tonight.
Ma, you can't play gin, he said, smiling a little.
For a penny a point, I can beat the tailgate off a kid like you.
Maybe if I gave you 400 points.
Listen to the kid, she jeered softly. Maybe if I gave you 400.
Stick around, Larry. What do you say?
All right, he said.
For the first time that day, he felt good. Really good. A small voice inside whispered he was taking again. Same old Larry, riding for free. But he refused to listen. This was his mother, after all. And she had asked him. It was true that she had said some pretty hard things on the way to asking, but asking was asking, true or false.
Tell you what, I'll pay for our tickets to the game on July 4th. I'll just peel it off the top of whatever I skin you out of tonight.
You couldn't skin a tomato, she said amiably, then turned back to the shelves.
There's a men's down the hall. Why don't you go wash the blood off your forehead? Then take $10 out of my purse and go to a movie. There's some good movie houses over on 3rd Avenue still. Just stay out of those scum pits around 49th and Broadway.
I'll be giving money to you before long, Larry said.
Record's number 18 on the Billboard chart this week. I checked it in Sam Goody's coming over here.
That's wonderful. If you're so loaded, why didn't you buy a copy instead of just looking?
Suddenly there was some kind of a blockage in his throat. He harrumphed, but it didn't go away.
Well, never mind, she said. My tongue's like a horse with a bad temper. Once it starts running, it just has to go on running until it's tired out. You know that.
Take 15, Larry. Call it a loan. I guess I will get it back one way or the other.
You will, he said.